Hello again, Paul Carenza here, you there. Paul Savage is on this episode as well. It's catching up with me, Paul Carenza, saying hello and what are you doing to various different people. And this time it's comedian, illustrator, comic book writer and boat owner, Paul Savage. Coming soon, other people. Tony Vino, Gareth Jones, David Hamilton. Yes, diddy David Hamilton. He's a guest on my other podcast, The British Broadcasting Century, and I thought we'd put the full interview on here. Yes, legends, I tell you. Plus, we've got comedians, poets, people with no connection whatsoever to showbiz. And indeed, if you want to be a guest yourself, do get in touch. Paul at paulcarenza.com. Hey, that's what Paul Savage did. He's a friend of mine. He wanted to catch up. I thought, let's record it and put it out here. So here he is talking about creativity under lockdown and, well, everything that spins off that. I hope you enjoy. And if you like the sound of Paul Savage, do buy his book. The link is in the show notes. So here in this latest series of conversations just put out there for you, it's Paul Savage.
One of the things I was thinking of doing with the when everything came to a crashing halt in March last year was, so I moved in with my sister and took care of her two small children who were 2 and 4. But they go to bed at like 7 o'clock. So I was like, oh, in the evening, I shall podcast. I shall have this idea that I've had for years and I shall draw comics. And just none of that happened because I was just so exhausted from childcare. Yeah. Which is, I mean, I've always known is a difficult thing. I've never wanted, but you know, there's certain things in the culture of, you know, like, oh, stay at home parents, cool, they've got it easy. No, it's really difficult. Like trying to teach as well. You're obviously doing some of the home learning. But I remember having a chat with the 4-year-old. She'd got her sheets that they'd sent home from school and going, like, just literally could not get her to focus at all, just like making stupid noises. And I was like, are you like this for Miss By, your teacher? And she was just like, oh, absolutely not. Of course, I'd never be like this.
Oh, well, thank you. If I'm honest, I think the frustration we've had has been when we hear from people who aren't in this situation and they go, has this put you off being a teacher then? Has it put you off, you know, turns out you don't know as much physics GCSE as you thought. And you end up thinking, actually, it's not about the lack of teaching. I could do the teaching. It's tricky is doing the teaching of two different ages and also trying to do my own work at the same time. And that combination is problematic. It's just when this isn't homeschooling, really, is it? You know, I know someone who homeschools like in normal times. And that is when you focus entirely on just you are teaching the kids. Also, you're teaching what you want as well, rather than a syllabus dictated to you by the school, whether it's handouts or video calls or whatever. But, you know, you are saying, hey, today we're going to go and walk in nature and learn about that stuff. Or today, cooking in the morning and, you know, French in the afternoon, whatever. But yeah, working someone else's syllabus on, you know, your own boss's timetables is difficult. This is lockdown life in all of its gritty glory, isn't it? So, you know.
Yeah, it's, but it has been difficult moving these things around of taking what your sort of skills are, and like even for someone like you and I who are both creative types and are used to flying by the seat of our pants with an idea of going, yes, I will do this thing for fun, this one will pay money, this one will be a thing that I can turn into something at some point, and then just, but like the stability generally has been the X amount you make from the comedy circuit or from regular writer jobs.
And that's the bit that's gone.
It disappeared. Like,
yeah, it's partly the fun of live stand-up's gone, but also there was a regularity to it. Unlike, you know, it's odd how people often think, maybe wrongly, I don't know, that the writing side of things is more reliable because it's stay at home and it's sturdy. Whereas the stand-up feels, you know, crazy and eclectic, and that's not a real job, surely. Whereas oddly, that's more predictable and reliable than the other stuff, really. So there's the stand-up going means suddenly like, well, oh right, it's little projects, it's weird projects time now.
Yeah, and it's the thing with weird projects is you don't know what makes money, because if you did, you would have already been doing it for a while. The podcast market was a fairly crowded marketplace anyway, and then 100 other people jumped on and went, I need an income. And lots of people who were doing all right, you know, reasonably famous people have now gone, yeah, we're going to podcast from our house. And you go, cool, I've got to compete with the people who are on The Office and the sort of, and everyone's, you know, especially if they're doing stuff, there's only a certain amount of advertising money in the podcast game. There's the rest of it is paid for by people doing, you know, stuff like Patreon or sort of these little, you know, voluntary buy me a coffee on that sort of thing. And again, that's a limited amount of money that can be sloshing around. So you can go, yeah, this guy, he created his own podcast and he gets £20,000 a month for people donating. And you go, it's brilliant for him, but like, I can't replicate that. It's the same with lots of things. I know so many people who, for instance, I am a cartoonist. I draw comics and I know so many people who are like, oh, I don't like comics. And I always think, well, you've not had the right introduction. You've not read the right ones in the same way that, you know, certain people who don't like reading books probably haven't read the ones that, you know, would have ticked off their little things. You know, I think the way we teach, I think it has got better in the last 20 years, but where I remember when I was at primary school, there was definitely a thing of, oh, you're reading books with pictures in.
Right. Yeah.
What's like, are you too stupid to be able to read the proper stuff? And you go, no, actually it's a whole different thing. It's its own, its own language and its own visual, texture. And it's a different thing to reading our book, you know?
Yeah.
In the same way that, you know, watching an animated film is a different thing to watching a film. It doesn't mean necessarily that it's, you know, just because it was coded for children back in the day doesn't mean there aren't great animated films that are coded for adults. And it doesn't mean that there's, you know, live action kid stuff that's not great as well. You know, I think we sometimes get into our heads that, you know, one thing is for us, one thing isn't for us. And yeah, it's the same with, I know loads of people who are like, oh yeah, I really love stand-up, when you tell them you're a comedian. They go, oh, you go, oh, great. And they're like, yeah, I went, whoa, it must've been 5 years ago. And then there's other people who are going, you know, week in, week out. And,
Well, there's a comedian. Well, one of the things with the stand-up boom is there's a comedian for everyone now. It used to be my mum could think of, I don't know, maybe Billy Connolly and maybe Jasper Carrot, possibly Lee Evans.
Yeah.
And then now she could name you 50 comedians and you go, oh, I don't quite like David Mitchell, but, you know, I prefer a bit of that James Acaster. And, you know, everyone's got their niche now if you just need to try it and find it.
Yes. And that's the sort of beautiful thing of the democratization of the internet. But also one of the slightly upsetting things is it does force that onto you, the creator, to be making the thing, like, because you're just like, oh, I'm just going to plow my own furrow, and you have to be like, no, I've got to market my own furrow as well. I've got to plow my own furrow and then put the seeds in and then tell everyone about my lovely corn, and I'm going to spend three times as much time telling people about my lovely corn as just plowing, which is the bit I enjoy. I don't know if anyone enjoys plowing. I think that metaphor lost it at a certain point. But
tell me about your book, and indeed books and all of those things. What's available, what will be available, and all that jazz.
So it's my book. It's called But Doctor, I Am a Collection of Comic Strips by Paul Savage, which is, if that reference is exactly niche enough for you, that you're probably going to like the rest of the book. It's lots of little 1 and 3 panel comics that I drew. So I put two books of them out previously, sort of about 2013, 2015, right. And then always meant to keep drawing and then just didn't, because fundamentally quite lazy. And then as it got to September this year, realized that I had no income, and because the kids had gone back to school, and needed some sort of thing to do, because the gigs were coming back in gently but not to any sort of level. I'd been keeping basically a folder on my phone of like, that's an idea for whenever you get round to starting drawing comics again, you know, the sort of vague wording of it, or that's a funny little idea for it. And so I just was like, right, what I'll do is I'll smash through those. And so I, cause I live on a boat in London normally, but it's not the most conducive atmosphere to working. So I
we'll come back to the boat then. That sounds weird. There's a talking point in the boat, certainly, isn't there?
Yeah, yeah. Mm. And so one of the things I did was just I moved back to my parents for 2 weeks and smashed through it, like took my ADHD medicine properly and stayed up and like had a proper working thing and did a Kickstarter for it, which helped because that way there's a what's the word I'm looking for? A deadline, and you'd be letting people down if you didn't.
Yeah.
Give them something for the money that you've
that makes you do it, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Mm. There was and that way it was forcing me to do it in a way that I can't force myself to do work, if you know what I mean. Having a useful deadline, something to just say, you need to start work at this point. You need to do 8 comics today, and you didn't do enough yesterday. So push through. And it was quite nice, actually. It was a nice way to, you know, sit and have my headphones on for 3-4 hours. And because people have already paid into the Kickstarter, you feel like you are basically paying yourself a wage. So this is your job, and you don't need to get distracted with other stuff, which is I think one of the things that distracts me a lot from general self-employment is pitching for other work, is to have, because I've never properly had an agent, you know, I've had people looking after parts of my diary before, but never had anyone be so controlled over it that I don't need to worry about it, you know. And that sort of thing of being able to just go, right, cool, there are no gigs, there's nothing's going to be happening in 6 months' time, so you don't need to put work in your diary for 6 months' time, because the work that you put into the diary 6 months ago doesn't exist anymore. So there's no point expending your emotional energy on that.
That's wonderful. It does ease up some pressure, doesn't it? Getting in touch with that promoter. No, not right now. Yeah, really.
Exactly.
So only to check how they are. That's the only reason.
Exactly. And some of the social media stuff, I fooled myself into believing that I was on there for a reason, because I do get a fair amount of work from, you know, there's boards on the Facebook pages of comedy clubs going, we need someone tonight, can you get in the car? And you're like, yes, I can. And that, you know, could be several thousand pounds over the course of a year, the amount I get from that. And so that is justified that I am on there numerous hours a day. And then you get to a point where you're like, there's no gigs, you don't need to be on this. You are wasting your own time. You're like, okay, cool. I don't need to be on there. I can log out. I can just sit and do 3 hours work and
I was
listen to an album that I've not listened to in
full. Yeah, so that helps.
So long, yeah.
I was chatting to a writer this week who's trying to write I think her first novel, and her advice that she's just taken on from a writing tutor was not to, you know, people often say to writers, oh, you should read more books, because you know, writers need to be readers. And I for a while I wasn't really reading many books, and I thought, I do need to read more, you're right. But her advice was the opposite. She said, I decided I'm not going to read anything at all in this week, not forever, but just for this week, I'm not going to read anything. And if I find myself reading something, you know, slap on the wrist and get back to writing. And I thought, that's a bit draconian. You've got to read to be a writer, surely. And then I thought, well, actually, no, she's not really just talking about reading books, because if I just read books, that would be a marvelous thing. But I'm reading, you know, I'm doom scrolling on Twitter and Facebook and reading BBC News articles and all those things. And I'm reading the odd bit of a page of a book now and then, but 99% of my reading has to be social media or Wikipedia rabbit holes, and that can go. I don't need that really as much as I'm currently doing.
When the first gardens were done in the 18th century, the sort of ornamental ones. They put all these, like the big rich landowners put all these trees in, like very nice order. Mm. And then they all died about 3 years later because you need a certain amount of gross stuff in there. You need bushes and leaves falling off and the mulch of and the worms and the bugs in the leaf litter coming through. Whereas these are all sort of like you put plant the tree, you put a lawn around it, you scrape it all down to be perfect, like inch high grass, and it's sterile and you don't get anything from that. And so there's a part of me that goes, yeah, I should be mucking around, because the amount of times an idea hits you in the back of the head and you go, oh yeah, that's perfect. And there is a nexus point for that of you watching a thing or seeing a thing and, and just going, oh yeah, that's something I can grab onto that. You know, the amount of times that I've written jokes on social media because somebody else has misused a phrase or they've, and you've gone, oh, that's a easy enough phrase to jump on. I mean, the one that I, it's the second joke that I do when I'm, gigging, which is the because I always do two jokes right at the start just to A, prove I can do a joke, and B, prove it wasn't an accident, and then made them laugh twice, and then the audience are more likely to be on your side.
So I did an online gig last week, and it, you know, with a proper audience there on Zoom, and one of the other comedians on was doing some old stuff I'd not heard for years. I thought, oh yeah, good, he's digging deep and doing the old stuff. I've got a story that would fit this bit now, so I mentally leapt to that. And I started it, and it's quite a long, got, you know, a good couple of minutes in, which is on the long side for a stage story. And I just reached that point, and I could see it coming on the horizon. Like, I don't know how this ends. I can't remember. I used to do it all the time.
Yeah.
And I just reached that dead end, and I had to do that thing of just go, and I've just forgotten it. So we'll move on. And they sort of did an awkward laugh and moved on. And the other comedian afterwards said, oh yeah, I thought that was because you just realized it was a rude punchline and you pretended you forgot it. And nope, just forgot it. It's been a year and I'm now in my 40s and I can't remember things anymore.
It's very interesting, actually, looking back at some of the jokes that I used to do and realizing that they are structurally fine, that you just can't get away with them because you're not in that stage of life anymore.
Right.
Whereas when I was doing jokes when I was 3-4 years into comedy, when I was 27, I would have been you know, I'm drinking too much and I've rubbish with girls and I keep getting fired from jobs. And the jokes are still structurally valid. But when you're 37, people are like, all right, you need to have worked on some of this stuff, please. you can't be this pointless little man child anymore. I was having a little, I don't know what I'm doing with my, like, I should have been, I think I should have done more out of lockdown. And he was like, you wrote a book and was a full-time nanny for 6 months.
Exactly.
Like,
you've educated.
And you're like, oh yeah, that's
something.
Yeah. That's a thing. And it's just cause I've not started, cause all of my mates are doing streaming online and, you know, and I did about 2-3 online gigs and I didn't like them. And the two things you can do with that is you go, right, well, I'm going to find a method that I like and do it better. I'm going to invest some time and energy into learning how to play Zoom gigs in the same way that you used to have to learn how to play the horrible clubs. You know, I'm not saying that this is just the first one that came to mind. And I know that not all of them were horrible, but people used to have sets for jongleurs, you know, it was a big club Saturday night full of staggered hens. And when they were with you, really great nights. When they weren't, it was really tough and it was horrible. And people went, is this what I got into comedy for, to be heckled and abused by people who don't really know what they're what they want. And people went, okay, you just have to learn to play it or learn to not play to be booked for those clubs, you know.
Well, and back in the glory days of stand-up, I remember that people would, you know, you could do jonglers so often that some comedians would say, oh, I'm trying to make sure I only do jonglers, you know, once a month, or maybe twice a month at push, because they'll have me 4 weekends a month. And, you know, if I do that, I become that sort of comedian. And once a month is enough for me because it pays nicely or whatever. And then the rest of, you know, I'll do nicer art center gigs that don't pay as well, but I can work on my craft. As if we could be so picky, even in the last 5-10 years, you know, that was the sort of early noughties when you could actually take your pick and go, oh, yes, no, thank you, jonglers. Once a month is enough for me. And now we go, please, anything, just send me some live audiences, you know.
I remember talking to Gordon Southern about the sort of boom days of stand-up in the sort of late 90s, early 2000s, and him saying he lost 10 grand one Edinburgh and didn't even notice because he earned that in a week of doing student gigs immediately after in the Freshers Week. Was just sort of like, and it was money in, money out. He went, yep, that, but for those two periods, I made rough, like I made a rough profit. I paid the mortgage. Who even really noticed? And you're just like, that's insane. But that was just the money was sloshing around then. And then, everyone sort of noticed that that probably wasn't sustainable.
But different times.
I think partly it's just there's so much more of everything. Not there was what there would have been 5 channels. There would have been, you know, five channels. A CD cost 10 quid. And so you, and a gig cost a couple of quid to go see. So yeah, you could go do these things. Whereas now it's more, yeah, I'm going to spend my money sensibly, or because, you know, there's certain stuff I look at where you go, oh, my book costs 10 quid. That is a month's worth of Netflix. I don't exactly know how much Netflix is, but you go, okay, so I've got to make it value for money. I've got to be entertaining throughout because I'm aware that people are putting their money into one thing or another. I'm not saying that my thing is as good as an entire month's worth of Netflix, but there was a lot of work went into it. Please buy my book.
Well, that's exactly. Well, there's a lot of competition now for culture, cultural ears and eyes and stuff, isn't there? And, on the one hand, I'm despondent because obviously you look back at those early days of the noughties stand-up circuit and think we will not see the like of those gigs again. And the gigs that were pretty well paid, they'd look after you, get you a nice hotel, you'd be there in the jacuzzi on a Saturday morning, having had a nice show the night before and a good show the next night. And that's not happened for a good decade and a bit, you know, in the main, it seems. But, and let alone after this, when the gigs do come back, they won't be, you know, the glory days are gone in many ways. So on the one hand, that's despondent. But on the more hopeful side, I suppose, I think, yeah, but back then there weren't podcasts and the ability to do ebooks in quite the same way. And, you know, let alone this live streaming thing, if that persists or whatever, there's, you know, there's so many more outlets. We couldn't make things for YouTube or Twitch or TikTok in the same way as we could then. Yeah. And obviously some of these can be a bit of a race to the bottom in terms of financing them and how you actually get paid. But, you know, people do break through on those. And, you know, there is a way to both earn a living, but also satisfy that cultural thing of performing and writing and getting stuff out there in a different way. So it's a changing marketplace. We've got to roll with it. You've got choice in a way. So, you know, you can hopefully see it optimistically and embrace it.
Yeah. And there's loads of stuff where I look at it now of, cause I didn't just make books. I made sort of t-shirts and mugs and stuff. And there's no gatekeepers to that. You can, like, if you wanted 20 years ago to have a mug that people could buy, you probably have to write a funny thing, write 100 different ones, take them to, you know, Clinton's or whatever and say, I would like to have funny things written on mugs. And they'd go, cool, we think these 4 are the best. And you go, I'm not sure they are, but okay. And then they'd make 25,000 of them. They'd put them in Clinton stores around the country. You probably get a check for it at the end, but you make maybe, I don't know, a quid on each mug. And nowadays you can just go, right, I'm going to do some funny tweets and I'm going to stick a link to my mugs underneath the ones that pop off and go, yeah, you could like the amazing stuff of like, you see a viral tweet and then underneath it, they've just gone, hey, I'm also doing this if you want it. And then that's now a legitimate way to make a living. I got an iPad for Christmas for drawing more. And one of the rules of it is for work. It's not a not a fun thing. There's no there's no games installed on it. There's no, like, if I'm putting books on it, it's for that sort of they don't have to be like educational necessarily, but they are, you know,
it's for work. It's
something in there.
Whereas to make it a tax expense. Yes, I understand. Yeah. Yeah, I get it.
Yeah, there's that as well. But yeah, you can definitely prove it's for work. Then it's a valued object.
But I know what you mean. There is separately from the finances, there is a certain value in keeping certain things as work and separating that from fun stuff, and that includes workspace. You know, people say don't try not to work in your bedroom if you can help it. You know, I've got bookshelves for work stuff, a researchy bookshelf, and I've got a sort of more, you know, the general fun reading bookshelf. And we're not working on a project. You know, I did the History of Christmas a few years ago. That was on the work bookshelf, so that I could go there for research. And I've done with the History of Christmas for now, so that's now on the general bookshelf. And I've got the History of Broadcasting where that was. So that's, I've got my go-to place, and it just helps, I think, file away the right stuff. Work there, fun there. And I can quite see the appeal of that with your device as well.
Yeah, well, it was one of the things that I came across by accident with doing stand-up was when I first started doing gigs that were sort of distance away. So in the first couple of years, I had a tremendously crappy car. I think I bought it for about 400 quid, and it had fans rather than aircon. And so in the summer, it would just push hot air around. And you'd have the windows down a bit, but obviously if you're on the motorway, that's really noisy. So I'd get to these gigs and I'd be there with sweat circles under my arms. And I always felt that was quite a rude thing to do to an audience, is just turn up with sweat circles under your arms. Like, so I started taking a t-shirt to change into, and just the difference it made in my stage presence of like, you're flipping through your notes, you go, when am I on? Oh, you're on in about 5 minutes. Cool, I'll change into my t-shirt now. And just changing from like one t-shirt to another was putting on work clothes. It was putting on a uniform of going to work and put you in that headspace of, this is your job, this is what you're doing now. And then you're just, it was a noticeable improvement in my in my sort of performance, because it was like I was still taking it seriously before that, but you know what I mean. There's a sort of like, oh, that's a little twist for yes, I can go and do that. I think it's just a good little bit of practice that I've got into. I know people who are illustrators who have illustrating clothes that they go around the house in, and they said that they started it because they were mucking around with paints and stuff and didn't want to ruin their good clothes, but they carry on doing it even though they're now digital artists, because it is getting in that headspace. It's getting into that work situation.
As we career towards our conclusion here, but
what have we learned?
Would you like to tell us any a favourite gig story that you've been unable to tell in the last year due to lack of gigs, but, you know, get it off your chest, and equally, of course, see if you can still remember it, because there's every chance that, you know, it's gone to the back of the head now.
I'll tell you a story that I've only ever told on, it was like a storytelling night. Because it's not funny enough to be a bit of stand-up, and also I don't think it's fair to the people involved.
Okay, so here's a story that's not funny and not fair. Lovely. Take it away.
There's a guy who I'd met at a gig. You know, you'll know from like comedies, occasionally you'll meet people at gigs, you friend them on Facebook, they run a gig, and then 2 years down the line they'll say, oh, we've got a space open, do you want to come and do our gig? I was like, yes, please. So it was supposed to be a fundraiser for a village hall, some place in outside a little city in the in England, and it was, you know, it's Saturday afternoon, early evening. We're going to have a barbecue in the back garden, then we're going to raise money for the village hall or the church hall. I forget which one it was.
Yeah.
And sort of like, it's 100 quid. Could you bring another comedian with you as well? And I was like, yep, that sounds absolutely perfect. We can do that. And then on the morning of the gig, I get a text saying, this is promoter's mum. He's not been very well, so the gig's cancelled. I said, okay, that's a shame, but thank you for letting me know. Anything, and she was just like, oh, he's just not been taking his medicine and he's got himself quite ill. I was like, oh, okay. About 3 o'clock, I get a text saying, you still okay for the gig? And I was like, oh, I heard it was cancelled. And he was like, no, just come and pick me up from this postcode. So I get my mate and we get in the car and we drive over to this place, and it's the grounds of a hospital. And so we're looking through it, and there's like, it's like the building is called like the Gordon Smith building or whatever. It's just a sort of fairly innocuous looking building, and he comes out through the double doors, gets in the car, and we start driving over to this gig. And then we notice that he's just a bit off, just a bit altered, just like starts mentioning some book that he was reading, and he goes, oh yeah, I was reading that, but I was reading that the other day, but I couldn't see straight because I was on so much diazepam that it was melting in front of me. And we share a look like, oh, this is going, there's something is very not right here.
Right.
So we turn up to the gig. The gig has been cancelled. So the people are just having a barbecue in the back garden. So the, instead of them doing a gig inside to them, he sort of runs around and corrals them all and goes, yeah, we're still doing a gig. And so we do a gig under the security lights by the bins to this, to as mostly disinterested group of people. He's going around drinking, the promoter is going around drink, like minesweeping all the drinks.
Right.
And it was supposed to be clean. He'd not told us this. It was supposed to be clean comedy. So he was, every time we said a rude word, he'd heckle us with a wet penny whistle.
Right.
And just, so he gave us a blast on that, but we were like, we don't know what is going on here. This is very weird. And then, so I text his mum, because I've still got the message from the morning. She's like, we've got this promoter, your son. And she's like, yeah, I'm really glad to hear that, because the police let us know when there was a jailbreak from the psychiatric ward, which is where we'd come and picked him up from.
I see.
And basically, he'd somehow he'd ordered a pizza in to the psychiatric ward. As they turned up, him and two others had made an escape, and we'd essentially been the getaway drivers. So we then we're like, so do you want him back at yours or do you want him back at? And she was like, yeah, the hospital, please. That would be really good. So we then have to drive back into the city centre of Lincoln. There were police roadblocks because they literally shut down the city centre of Lincoln because there was an escaped psychiatric patient who we had in our car.
So you can deliver him to a roadblock. It's like, I believe this is the person you're looking
for. Yeah, and that's it. So it was like just sort of sneaking past, just being like, because obviously we don't want to set him off. We don't want to, you know. So we eventually get there, and as he's, we're like, okay, here we are. I think this is you now. This is, and he's wearing my, because he told us suit and boots, so I'm wearing, he's wearing my suit jacket because he'd been in the, and I was just, as he was going in there, I was just like, I don't think I'm seeing that suit jacket again. Just, and it was really interesting because me and the comedian were sort of like, at the start, it had been a little bit sort of like, a little bit fun. We knew that we were, this wasn't quite right, but it was a bit, you're like, oh, it's a wacky road trip. It's a little bit of an event. And then we were just like, oh, this is actually quite sort of emotionally exhausting and really tiring. And like,
so at least it's a memorable gig. There's that.
Yeah, yeah. And so that's it. When I have to be like, oh, I really miss gigging. I have to remember not all of them.
Yeah, like, that's
so
true.
So sometimes you get like lovely rounds of applause and people are very nice and you get paid properly. And then sometimes you accidentally jailbreak a psychiatric ward.
Well,
who knows what weird gigs and awful gigs we are avoiding by not being able to legally have any gigs right now. So there's one upside.
always looking for the silver lining.
Absolutely. You've got to find it, haven't you? Last, mention your book again before we go then. What's your book called and where you find it?
It's called But Doctor, I Am, a Collection of Comics by Paul Savage. It is available on my website, which I've had redone specially. So that's savagecomic.com. You can find me on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, trying to put comics out there. Comic is only a tenner, and if you pay me a couple of quid extra, I will draw a bespoke doodle for you in the front leaf, which I always do, because it's always very interesting finding out what people are. I think it's quite a good way to find out what people are like. If you say, what would you like drawn in the front cover of your book? And they'll say something weird. And you go, okay, cool. Or they'll just be like, oh, I don't know, a flower, whatever. And you're like, okay, cool, I could do that. But some people have been like, I want me scoring in front of the cop, in front of microphones that are all screaming my name. You're like, yeah, I could draw that for you. That was a genuine one, by the way.
Really? So you pretend that you're doing them a favour, but really you're just stockpiling their weirdnesses in a large file in your brain. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I did take pictures of all of them for ages and then did nothing with them.
You need a nice lockdown to do something with those. That's the thing. You need a bit of time. Yeah. Great to chat. Thank you, Paul.
Lovely to chat to you. I'll speak soon. And
keep on creating. Wish you well. Cheers, buddy.
Cheers, mate.
Thank you, Paul Savage. Buy his book. Buy my books. Listen to my other podcast, The British Broadcasting Century. And hey, if you do none of those things, then you are still very welcome. Thank you for being here. Part of this, listening to me saying to you that you are a good un, you, and you deserve happy days and happy things. And you're going to get some happy days and happy things. And if today's not one, then just wait. Bit longer. Can you see it? It's there on the horizon. Well, till next time, it's me, Paul Carenza, saying thank you for catching up. May you fare well.